So too, the book of the week, written and read by Val McDermid, Forensics, the Anatomy of Crime, explores the history and development of forensic science. Today, how experts in the fields of anthropology and facial reconstruction provide vital information to criminal investigations.
The first recorded instance of an anthropologist featuring in a criminal trial was in 1897 in America. George Dorsey was an ethnographer who specialised in Amerindians. He had been taught by Thomas Dwight, the so-called father of forensic anthropology, who had led the way in the subject's early development. Dorsey was drawn into a case that occupied the front pages of the newspapers for weeks. Adolf Leutgert had emigrated to Chicago from Germany as a penniless 21-year-old in 1866. For 15 years, he worked odd jobs at tanneries and removal companies until he'd saved $4,000, enough to build a factory and set up the A.L. Leutgert Sausage and Packing Company. Sausages from the factory were soon distributed all over the city and beyond, earning Leutgert the title of the Sausage King of Chicago. The burly sausage entrepreneur had married an attractive woman called Louisa, but the marriage was a long way from the American dream. Adolf began to sleep with other women. Rumours spread that he beat his wife. On the 1st of May 1897, the pair went out for a spring stroll, but only Adolf returned. Unconvinced by Adolf's story that she'd run away with another man, Louisa's family went to the police, who carried out an extensive search, eventually turning to the Leutgert sausage factory. As they walked through the factory, the police noticed a peculiar smell coming from a large vat used for steaming sausages. Peering into the vat, the officers noticed a sludge at the bottom, which one described as having a very sickening smell, something dead around it. They decided to investigate further. A plug on the outside was withdrawn, and some gunny sacks were spread on the floor at the bunghole. As the liquid passed out, a slimy sediment and a number of small pieces of bone were deposited on the sacks. The vat was then further searched, and at the bottom there were found two plain gold rings, stuck together and covered with a slimy reddish-grey substance. The smaller was a guard ring, the larger a wedding ring, and on the inner surface of the latter was engraved in script, LL. This was later confirmed as Louisa Leutgert's wedding band, a gift from her husband. In light of this weight of evidence, Leutgert was arrested. The trial was held at the Cook County Courthouse amid an atmosphere of fevered public interest. George Dorsey testified for the prosecution that the bones were human and that they included bones from the foot, finger, ribcage, toe and skull of a woman. A further witness testified that the slime found in the vat contained hematin, a chemical created by the decomposition of hemoglobin found in human blood. Yet another witness said that before Louisa's disappearance, Adolf had bought several hundred pounds of lye, a caustic compound that can be used for such wildly different purposes as curing meat, cleaning ovens, and making methamphetamine, which he'd gradually added to the sausage dipping vat. Adolf testified that the lye was for cleaning the factory. The prosecution countered that lye is strongly alkaline, good at dissolving large objects. The first trial produced a hung jury. The jurors were so far from agreement that they nearly came to blows in the deliberation room. But Leutgert wasn't off the hook. The following year, a retrial was held. George Dorsey testified again. And this time, Leutgert was found guilty of murdering his wife. Facial reconstruction. Never mind fingerprints or DNA. What makes us recognisably individual to each other are, of course, our faces. Our brains are highly skilled in recognising minute differences in other people's faces, and we can identify hundreds of them as a result. At only 5 weeks old, babies can distinguish their mother's faces, and 2.5% of people grow up to be super recognisers, capable of identifying nearly every face they have ever seen. But death steals our faces from us. Our flesh decomposes, nature strips us back to the bone, and the skull beneath the skin means nothing to the people who knew and loved us. Thankfully, there is a small band of scientists whose work is dedicated to giving the dead their faces back. In the UK, Richard Neave established the technique of facial reconstruction from skeletal remains at Manchester University. In 1973, using plaster and clay, he rebuilt the faces of two 4,000-year-old Egyptian mummies, known as the Two Brothers. Neave developed great skill in modelling the muscles of the face and skull, which provided a lattice work for the rest of the flesh and skin to sit on. Having refined his skills in the archaeological sphere, he turned to forensic work and was involved in more than 20 cases of unidentified remains, with a 75% identification success rate. Developments in medical technology have generated important developments in the field of facial reconstruction. X-rays and CT scans of living people have been remarkable sources of data. As a result, facial reconstruction is now more accurate and consequently more trusted than ever before. Nowadays, 80% of forensic facial reconstruction is computer-based. Computer modelling is quicker than clay modelling, but there are advantages to the computer method other than speed. Craniofacial modellers don't only use computers to create a face as it once was, but also as it might now be, especially in the case of missing persons. The process of age progression can be automated to a significant degree. Our ears grow longer as we grow older, and algorithms exist to plot the basic sagging and puffing of an ageing face. But age-progressed images are largely down to the instincts and experience of the artist, who looks at sequences of photographs of people as they get older and identifies general trends. The artist uses photos of older siblings for guidance, adapts the image to reflect the kind of life a subject may have led, and adds distinctive clothing or facial hair. Fine details like liver spots can be added manually too. The hunt for missing people can also be hampered by changes to their appearance that have nothing to do with ageing, and which can be affected by techniques as simple as growing facial hair. Radovan Karadzic is a former Bosnian Serb politician who was indicted for war crimes in 1995 by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Among other atrocities, Karadzic was charged with ordering the 1995 Srebrenica massacre, in which 8,000 Bosnians were murdered. After his indictment, the butcher of Bosnia disappeared, shaved his hair, grew a beard, donned a priest's robes, and lived an itinerant life, wandering from monastery to monastery. Caroline Wilkinson, professor of craniofacial reconstruction at the University of Dundee, was asked to make an age-progressed image of Karadzic. She got the shape of his face spot on, but underestimated his beard. He'd moved to Belgrade and started wearing his long hair in a ponytail, donning large square glasses and hiding behind an enormous white beard. Calling himself Dabic, the spiritual explorer, he masqueraded as an expert in human quantum energy and gave public lectures. But the age-progressed images gave a new impetus to the hunt for Karadzic. In 2008, a year after Caroline had sent them her image, he was arrested by Serbian security forces and extradited to The Hague to stand trial. The trial is still going on. Caroline explains, "Our facial reconstruction methods have been blind tested many times using living subjects, and we know that approximately 70% of the facial surface has less than 2 millimetres of error. It's the application of science to the world of artistic representation that makes it possible for the dead to tell yet another chapter of their story to us." Digital forensics. When a computer, smartphone or tablet is found at a crime scene, it's often covered in fingerprints and DNA. But these tiny devices also contain a detailed, if partial, snapshot of a person's life. In the early 1980s, hard drive storage capacities were so small that a forensic digital analyst could often browse through all the files on a drive until he found what he needed to secure a conviction. But computing power continued to grow exponentially. When Microsoft launched Windows 95, they opened up the World Wide Web to ordinary people. At this point, the police started to take digital forensics seriously. In 2001, Home Secretary Jack Straw established the British National High-Tech Crime Unit. The unit took on new crimes that the digital revolution had made possible, like hacking, and old crimes which it had facilitated, like stalking. In 2006, the national unit was replaced by regional ones. Today, at a crime scene, when a unit doesn't have the capacity or expertise to analyse digital evidence, the senior investigating officer will call in an independent, like Angus Marshall of the Centre for Internet Computing at the University of Hull. The job is occasionally revelatory, usually methodical. It can take time to build up a digital picture. Angus creates his own tools to help. Most of the programmes I write are not very big or complicated. They simply automate things. In cases of child abuse, once such programmes have recovered all of the photographs and video files on a given hard drive, another goes through and tries to match them to a database held by the police. The database stores the origin of each image, if it's known. This means investigators can link the consumers of illegal media to the creators. It's a traumatic job, but independent experts like Angus, or more usually police officers, look very carefully at abusive photographs and videos to pick up clues as to where in the world they were taken. Angus explains, it can be subtle things like the shape of the electrical sockets, the sound of the TV or the language being spoken. You can approximate the time of day from where the sun is in the sky. And then there's the metadata, information which is embedded in images and video files taken on digital cameras and smartphones. Metadata reveals useful information from the make and model of the device to the date and time when the media was recorded. Although image manipulation software and file sharing sites sometimes strip metadata, it's often still buried there, and with the right software, it can be read. In the case of cybercrime, forensic digital analysts sometimes have to play catch-up with the criminals. The old adage holds true. When the forensic scientist takes a step, the criminal counters with a step of their own. Fingerprinting made burglars put gloves on. CCTV made kids pull their hoods up. There are all sorts of complicated anti-forensic techniques. Some programs allow users to change the metadata in files so that they can make a file look as if it was created in 1912 and last accessed in 2050. Others make files look to forensic programs as if they were another kind of file altogether. Thus, an expert could be tricked into thinking that an image file of a child being abused was an MP3 music file. Seeing through these ruses comes down to the ingenuity and experience of the forensic digital analysts. They have to be at the cutting edge of developments in the field in order to work out exactly what tech-savvy criminals are up to. The majority of people use the internet to do relatively innocuous things. Criminals also use the internet to do ordinary things. They write emails to family and shop with online retailers. But when they step down illegal paths, they leave a footprint that forensic digital analysts like Angus can decipher more clearly than many of them realise.
Val McDermid was reading Forensics, The Anatomy of Crime. It was abridged by Sian Preece and produced by Allegra McElroy. Tomorrow, Val explores the work of forensic psychologists. On Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes, Academy Award-winning film star Sophia Loren joins Jenny to recount stories from her colourful career. Then in From Our Own Correspondent at 11, Will Grant files a dispatch on the protests in Mexico City as families try to find out what happened to a group of students seized by the police, and Razia Iqbal discovers many of India's women are still suffering appalling violence.
Given it was so close, the pressure to have an Arthur referendum is going to be inexorable.
You're not going to get the toothpaste back in the tube, as they say in America.
BBC Radio 4 analyses the impact of the Scottish referendum.
In Scotland, you've got a whole generation who would normally be able to vote actually being excited by politics. How long it will last will be a question.
A.L. Kennedy, Simon Heffer and Helena Kennedy in After the Vote with Professor Linda Colley, on Tuesday morning at 9, and then available on the Radio 4 website.